Okay, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
All right, so this morning we're going to continue our discussion on housing, and we have Brad and Brandy here again from Community Development and Housing Department of the County, and Mike Costello here too, from representing the Constable's Office. So they're going to chime in on various pieces this morning. So when we met with you last Friday, we spent pretty much most of the day talking about housing, and we were provided with a set of goals, objectives, and strategies from the Sussex Housing Group Advocacy Committee, and we were given the charge from this group to review those, cross-check them with our work, and see if there were any gaps. So this morning we're going to go through some of the gaps. For the most part, what was covered in the strategies we did receive from the housing group was consistent with the information we presented. We have a lot of the things covered. There are a few things where we do want this group's feedback this morning on whether it should be moved forward with in the plan, because it wasn't something we talked about last Friday. Okay. Oh, also last Friday we had shown you two examples of language that the Community Development Housing Department had through their mission statement at the department, and also some language on their website. And we were given the charge to try to merge those two together into a vision statement. So this is what we've come up with. If you want to take a look at it this morning, we can also give it to Kim if she wants to wordsmith it. But
she's on her way.
Oh, she is. Okay, perfect.
Brad, are you and Brandy okay with this?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, so I'm going to just show a couple of the strategies that we didn't get a chance to talk about at the last meeting that were presented in this additional information that was given to us. So the goals and objectives were already talked about and approved at the last meeting. These are some strategies that might fall under these goals and objectives that were given to us through the public committee at the last meeting. So the first one actually is the one we talked about. And it was suggested that we change the language to strengthen the County Constable's Office existing rental unit complaint program for additional education and outreach efforts. So maybe, Mike, can you come up for just a moment and give a little briefing to the Planning and Zoning Commission about what the Constable's Office does? I know you weren't available last Friday, you were on vacation, but just to give them a little background about the reach of the Constable's Office.
Sure.
And what you do.
Good morning. So looking at this and addressing it from the Constable's Office point of view, the Constable's...
Mike, just for the record,
sure.
State your name for the...
Mike Costello. I'm the Government Affairs Manager with Sussex County and formerly the Chief County Constable. So looking at it from the Constable's Office perspective, we had established back in late 14 a rental unit complaint program. And what that does is it brings us into compliance with the state housing code's minimum requirements for rental unit complaints. So a process was developed, and we had assistance through our legal team, that if a person who was occupying a rental unit had a complaint regarding the minimum standards that are set forth in the state's rental program regarding the structure or the unit, that they could make a complaint to the Constable's Office. Depending on what the complaint was, if it actually fell into the line type issues, if it was like structural damage or there was poor sanitation, if there were issues that the property owner was responsible for, the County Constable's Office could make contact with the owner of that property, and we would end up performing an inspection, and if the inspection revealed some violations there, a corrective action plan and a notice of violation was sent to the owner of the property, giving them a certain amount of time to make those corrections. If they were made, we close it out and we move on. Sometimes we found that there were conditions there that were found in violation that, if left unchecked, would move the county to condemn the property, and we had actually done that on several occasions because the problems had not been corrected, and we realized that it can make a bad situation worse when somebody calls in here to make that complaint about the condition of the property, and if the owner of the property fails to make the correction, the only recourse we have at that point is to condemn the property and have it vacated. And that's what we had done up to that point. But that's meeting the minimum requirements of the state housing code. And we haven't made any further considerations to adopt our own code or to make any other higher marks, so to speak, in getting those issues corrected. So it's a staffing issue. It's a credentialing issue. We have to get inspectors certified to perform those inspections. And so anyhow, that's where we had come from. Early on, we received a number of complaints, and they seemed to kind of to fizzle off a little bit, and there was a need in a couple of the different communities within Sussex County. And we do have a program to address those. We make it known. You can get the rental complaint information is right on the county constable's website, so they can call in here. The majority of the other partners in state and local government, they're aware that the county has a rental unit complaint program, and when they are triaging calls, they can make appropriate referrals to get our services at that point.
So can I chime in here with 2 points? The first is that at the last meeting on Friday, we discussed the fact that there's a lot of interest from the public in the county doing a more active role in perhaps considering licensing and inspections. Can you talk about that, some of the challenges with that at this time first? And the second point was education and outreach. So the reason we changed the strategy to focus more about strengthening the existing program that you have with more additional education outreach is because I think Kim brought up the point that sometimes tenants are afraid to speak up if there is an issue because they're afraid they'll get evicted. So can you maybe talk to those 2 points?
What was the first point again?
The first point was just a more active, like doing licensing and inspection, code right. enforcement, like some other counties do certification of rental
sure.
units.
And taking a more active role, it's not the first time we've heard something like that, but let's think about what that means. In other jurisdictions, they have a rental unit, like you have to register your rental unit, you have to abide by inspections. These are jurisdictions where they have incorporated higher standards. We have the state minimum requirement for the housing code, but there are other standards out there, national standards, that require those things, and we have not adopted those things. For an example, I believe Newcastle County, they have a licensing and inspection program going on right now where they have licensed inspectors that go out and they, on an annual basis, they will do an inspection on a rental unit. It's required that if you're going to rent your place, you have to have an inspection at least annually. So they're in the business of doing that. So they, I believe it generates revenue because they have to get a permit, register that property, and every year it gets an inspection, and they make sure that it's meeting at least the state housing code minimum standards, if not the higher standards that the jurisdiction has. So there are other jurisdictions throughout the state that I'm aware of that do that too, but the county has not done that.
Mike,
yes.
Would that include the beach rentals?
No. If you're looking at it from the minimum standards of the state housing code, there are certain units that are exempt, and the resort type stuff, hotels, motels, migrant camps, those sorts of things are all exempt. As a matter of fact, the housing code is exempt from any, in 1987 when this was adopted, any existing structures that are owner occupied at the time, they're also exempt.
That was my next question.
Yes.
Yeah, but if they did exemptions, okay.
Yes. So there are certain exemptions for those. So in order for us to do that with the amount of rentals, and we really have no idea how many rentals we have in Sussex County, with no idea. Right. But to incorporate something that is, we're certainly talking about increase in staff, and I have no idea what that number would be. Training, certification, all those items.
Who does the enforcement now?
The constable's office does the enforcement.
Before 2014, we still had the state law, right? Who did it then?
I'm not sure.
So if someone wanted to call in a deficiency in their rental property, mm-hmm. there's not a state agency that enforces the state law?
Well, there is a state agency that enforces the state law. However, there is a requirement that the municipalities have to incorporate at least that minimum standard of the state law. And we did that in 1987, and I really can't speak to what happened prior to my coming here in 2014, but I know that since that time we have, I'm sorry.
I think, now don't hold me to this, but I almost think that it came to the Planning and Zoning Office back then, if there was a complaint, because it was before your time, mm-hmm. before we had that office. And I almost think that if it was either there or your department, Brett, I almost think it might have been you guys.
It was you guys.
Yeah. And you really didn't have the, you weren't really staffed for that.
No, we weren't. It's just kind of going back and forth between the constable and community development.
Yeah.
And I think building code actually had it for a little while. So.
Yeah, I was, yeah, that's right.
And nobody had the staff, was staff or training to do it on the level that it needed to be done. So Mike's done a very good job of updating it and following through with it.
Thank you.
Our approach, you know, to other issues, I hate to use the word similar, but other enforcement type issues is complaint based, and it's to avoid having to have annual inspections and a huge inspection staff and overhead, because specifically as it pertains to affordable housing, the more cost we add on, the less affordable housing becomes. And so we don't want to add a burden where we're already trying to find ways to relieve that burden. As far as the educational outreach, that seems very reasonable. What we can do there, whether it's in a tax statement or something of that nature, using the community groups, NGOs or whatever, and our own housing department, that seems very reasonable. I'm not so sure about, you know, creating some sort of an inspection process or whatever. I think that's going to be a tougher problem just because of the manpower required throughout the county. So.
Sure.
Mike, is there a, and if I'm jumping ahead, you want to finish your presentation first, go
ahead. Right.
But my question is, when you're talking about strengthening education, I guess my question is, who are we educating? Is there a program by which the tenants are actually informed of their right? I mean, I know everybody gets a copy of the landlord-tenant code whenever they sign a lease, but this specific issue of who to call if you have a problem, you know, it would seem to me to be important. I have a concern about creating another bureaucracy too. But I also would like to hear from the housing groups about how effective they think those efforts have actually been, too, because you're creating a. To create a license, you're talking about landlord licensing and rental property licensing. Just looking at a map of our county will tell you that that's going to be a huge, huge undertaking, big and expensive. And my thought is there another way that we can? Are there ways that we can make our existing system more effective? And when you think about education, do tenants even know that they can call your office, you know?
Well, to speak to who do you call if you have a problem, I think that we have done our best, especially early on in the program as we developed this, to get that information out. It's on the county constable's website. It's the other agencies and NGOs that we deal with from time to time. They're aware of it. It's out there for them. When we make community appearances, we speak of that, so the folks in these areas are aware of it. The problem is that what we had seen is that the majority of the issues that are getting complained about can be corrected between the owner of the property and the occupant, and sometimes don't have anything to do with the status of the property. It's all the extra relational type things, like they're getting evicted because they haven't paid rent in 6 months, so now I'm going to make a complaint. And it kind of muddies up the waters. It really does, and it occupies a lot of time. And we try to do our best, and which is one of the reasons why we require the occupant, if you're going to complain, you need to do it in writing to our office. It gives us an opportunity to actually take a look at it and see what it is that you're complaining about. When we see that you're getting you know, the complaint is you're getting evicted because you haven't paid rent in 6 months. There's, that has nothing to do with our
with the minimum standards. There's no remedy through your office
Correct.
For that. Yeah.
So we can clear those out. However, if the drywall is falling off of the ceilings in the bedrooms, that's something that we're interested in.
There's no water.
Yes. So those are interested. There were, you know, health and safety things. We're immediately looking at those. And so I can't really give you a percentage as to how many complaints we've received versus how many times we've actually had to do an inspection. But the inspections are often, they're a lot fewer than the complaints that have come in because we've been able to clear them out as not being part of the minimum standards. So the education and outreach, there are probably more opportunities for us to do those things. And as we grow in our program, we want to do that. If you look at the constable's office in general as a department within the organization, it's enforcement based. So when planning and zoning can't get compliance, they'll refer that for enforcement action. When building code can't get compliance, they'll refer it for enforcement action. Assessment, same thing. And then primarily the duties of the constable's office is to respond to complaints regarding property maintenance, trash, grass, vehicles, that sort of thing, and handle all the other zoning violations that get referred, building code referrals that get made over. So it's a small staff. It's the chief constable, a secretary, and two field staff for doing inspections. And you know, right now they are just turning and burning as fast as they can. We still have yet to get another inspector certified to do these rental unit inspections, so I'm still doing them.
What kind of certification do they have to go through?
International Property Maintenance, IPRMC,
yeah.
And the International Residential Code. So it's a very broad definition, but there's nothing that says that we have to be certified. But if we're going to go out and do these things, should we not have some credentials to say that I've inspected this and based on my knowledge, training, and experience, here's a violation? So that's what we're doing. So, again, the constable's office is primarily enforcement based, driven by the complaints that are referred over to them. And we are doing the resident or the rental unit complaints as part of that because that's just happened to be where it falls, and we're happy that we've got a system to deliver that need to the community. So I'm not really I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. No, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I'm just thinking.
To expand off of that, I'm not really sure what we could do. We have, you know, other than the getting the word out there that if you have an issue, you can contact the constable's office. Will provide the document for you to make the complaint. We'll triage it and determine whether it meets the need to schedule an inspection, and we'll do the inspection if need be.
Now, are our folks, when they go out to do these inspections, I'm looking at a state trooper.
Yes, sir.
Point of view. Are they safe? Are they carrying? Are they certified to carry and stuff like that?
No.
Are they going by themselves?
It's me. Yeah, and yes, I am.
And you don't? Wow.
No. And for the most part, when we're doing a rental unit complaint, the folks are happy to get us in there. We're not having any of those confrontational type issues.
Yeah, but you and I both know that certain places,
sure,
when you show up, whether they're involved in,
yes,
what you're doing or not, that could get ugly real quick.
Right. So to separate these rental unit complaints from all the other work that we do, if we're in these communities because of trash or vehicles or whatever the case may be, if we feel that there's a need to have a trooper on scene, we'll just make that phone call.
Okay.
They're right there. They have been a fantastic support to our because if you think about it, code enforcement offers the quality of life. You know, if you can get the grass cut and the trash cleaned up and the junk cars out of there, life seems to be better in these communities. And state police are on to that. So they are willing to contribute to provide somebody out there to guarantee our safety while we're doing our job. And we've never had an issue with that.
Awesome. Okay.
Thank you, Mr.
Okay. Thank you. Hang tight one more,
yes,
second. So the next strategy was one proposed by the public. Consider creation of a rental housing task force to develop non-punitive rental property standards and develop a process to identify rental properties throughout the county. Can you maybe just comment on what your thoughts are on that, if there's a way we should tweak it or consider it?
Sure.
Can I ask a question just on the drafting of it before Mike gets? When it says to identify rental properties throughout the county, is that to come up with a list of, like, available properties for rent?
I believe so. I think okay. Mike mentioned that you don't know. There's so many out there. Yeah. There's no idea where they are. And I know we have a strategy that we talked about last Friday about trying to identify the abandoned properties in the county.
Yeah,
so this would be identifying rental properties.
Yeah,
right.
I read that differently, Mr. Robertson.
That's why I asked the question. What's it mean?
My initial thought was that it's sort of that it was perhaps a precursor to, in order to license everybody, you have to identify them first. I'm not all that disturbed by there being a list, but if it's a list for marketing purposes, if it's a list of rental units for sale, then that's what it should say. Units for rent, or are we saying we want to identify every rental property in Sussex County?
But yeah, that's where I was coming from. Is it a resource for prospective tenants, whether they be affordable or not, and then also just providing this is what we expect, rental properties to lease.
I don't think it's for sale. I think it was to identify them
I'm not vehemently opposed to that, although it just begs the question, why do we want to identify them all?
Sorry, Brandon Altman with
because there might be good reasons
community
for
development.
So
I think our biggest struggle, and this was identified during the program where we helped veteran homeless. It's a really large struggle in Sussex County to find landlords and rental housing and affordable rental housing because, unlike Kent and Newcastle County, Sussex County being rural, there's a lot of the mom and pop type rentals. Someone's dad, just has, something like that. So it's not a project. I think it's a struggle to find those individuals and reach out to them and provide them with information about a fair housing or, the programs that are available to them through the voucher system or just finding tenants even because right now, a lot of people use the guide or they use individual real estate agents to market. This way we would just be able to deliver all these different resources to them and connect the tenants. So DelawareHousingSearch.org has started that. It's a website, as you're all familiar with the Delaware MLS system, which is for sale properties. DelawareHousingSearch.org was created by the Delaware State Housing Authority to market rental housing.
Yeah.
It's along the same lines, just to have kind of a one-stop shop to find and locate all of these houses.
So you think it is marketing based?
I think what I would like to see stated in the strategy is the purpose for identifying rental properties.
Okay.
Just so we're clear on what the intent is for that.
Sure.
For that information, and it's a worthy goal. I mean, it's a worthy intent. I hear what you're saying.
Yeah.
But I think we want to state that just to be clear.
And I think it does go hand in hand with the idea of creating a licensing program because of that you would automatically know where they are. So I think there's a way to maybe find them or locate them without doing the program. So.
Where does the property standards, development of rental property standards fall into this? I mean, there's state standards, right?
The development of develop non-punitive rental property standards, is that what you're asking?
It's punitive or non-punitive doesn't matter. We want to develop rental property standards, and there are already property standards, right?
So we do have property standards, and the fact of it being non-punitive, I believe that's where an occupant of a rental unit is in fear of some retaliation because they would make a complaint. Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, but I didn't draft that. Their strategy. So that's why. Yeah, I'm not sure what that.
I read it differently too.
Well, I have to say it really doesn't. When you look at it, it does cause one to think. Well, we already have standards. What's the non-punitive rental standard? Is this? And am I? Let me ask you a question. Could it be? Do you mean that there's sort of like going to be a baseline of standards that are required, and then these would be standards that might be higher but are voluntary somehow?
Well, to look at it from two different angles on here, take a look at it from the occupant. It's already against the law to retaliate against an occupant because they made a rental unit complaint. Okay,
that's so in the landlord-tenant code.
Yes, right. It's in the Delaware landlord-tenant code.
That's why I'm trying to understand what we're doing.
Right. Okay. So if we take that out of it and look at it from an authority getting into their rental unit business and the conditions of that, without any punitive standards, what would compel them to do anything?
But that's already state law.
Right.
So why would we need to develop something that already exists?
There's additional language that was provided that would outline out how to do this. It says include low-income housing tax credit, USDA, and HUD-supported rental property developers in the task force to identify and model rental property standards. Articulate these standards in such a way that they can be applied to other types of rental units without providing an additional regulatory or cost burden to affordable multifamily rental developers who already must comply with strict regulations.
What are you reading from?
It's the stuff from the housing group. That was provided last Friday. Number 1.6.2.1, if you have your sheet from last Friday.
I guess what's throwing us off, what's throwing me off, is the non-punitive. As Mike just said, if it doesn't have the force of law, then what compels people to do it? And I'm still not clear on what it is we're trying to. What rental property standards we're talking about.
Yeah, we already have standards. We already have a punishment.
That if you meet these sort of voluntary standards, then you would get on the list? You know what I mean? So that we're talking about to identify rental properties throughout the state. In other words, if that's going to be a marketing tool and is designed to match tenants with landlords, you know, that maybe that's the incentive, you would be on that list if you met those non-punitive standards based on USDA and everything else.
Instead of non-punitive, would another word be voluntary? What we're
really trying to do is identify rental properties. Why don't we just get rid of that stuff that we already have? We already have property standards, right?
Yes.
We already have a punitive statement in the state law that says if you punish a tenant for calling in, you're breaking the law. So we don't need to develop that, right? What we do maybe need to do is to consider a way to develop a process to identify rental properties throughout the county. Okay, so we can hook up, as Brandy says, rental properties with tenants. So we get rid of that middle language. Is that okay with you, Mike?
I see that we have standards. You're correct, and we have mechanisms for enforcing, taking the complaint, investigating the complaint, and working that through. So. Yes, for developing standards. Now, if you wanted to add additional standards in support of a licensing and an inspection type approach, I suppose that that would have to be part of that.
Personally, I don't have too much interest in that because, you know, it becomes ambiguous. You have a state law, you have a county law, then you have a local jurisdictional law, and then you don't know which law you have to follow. I mean, I think we're better off to stay with one law and one set of standards, and that's set by the state. Okay. So we conform to them. If there's a way that we can help identify the property rentals to match up tenants and landlords, I think that's very reasonable. Is that reasonable?
The way the state law is set up, the state, as I understand it, and somebody jump in if this isn't right, that the state has established the minimum standards. They have delegated the enforcement piece of that to the municipalities, though. What they've basically said is that here's the standard that we want observed. You guys are going to handle the violations and so on. We know we've got that much of it. And that's, you know, I think as Marty is saying, that's certainly a good place to be. We have some standards. We have a way for people's grievances to be redressed, which is probably my biggest concern. I just want to make sure that people who have an issue know where to go and who to talk to and how to get it fixed, and then they can do it without fear of retaliation from the landlord. And I think we have all that pretty much in place. But I know there are folks from the, you know, from the housing side here, and I was wondering if there's anybody else that might want to enlighten us. Amy, do you want to speak to this and Mike kind of help us understand what it is that's being suggested here? Because I'm still pretty confused, but I'm open to being straightened out.
Thank you, Bob. Amy Walls and I understand your confusion with our language here. So what our thought was with the rentals is, one, just trying to understand where they are. We're not actually proposing an annual inspection and an annual fee, but we think it would be really, you know, helpful to understand who they are, both from a, you know, how to communicate directly with the renters, with, you know, information about if you have a problem, but also who the landlords are so that you can then educate them about other vouchers and resources and the like. Related to the rental property standards, you know, our thought was that, you know, one, you know, if the county is happy with the state standards as they are, you know, that's fine with us. However, we think it might be helpful if the county, as part of their outreach efforts for the landlords, could, you know, send them that information so that they understood the standards.
That's the next one here.
Oh, thank you. But for those individuals who are reading the standards and aren't sure whether they're complying correctly, if they have the ability to call the constable's office and have them come out and walk through an inspection with them and in such a way that, you know, they feel like it's a very comfortable relationship to do so. Voluntary inspection to say, you know, hey, I want to do it. Yeah. I want to do it right. I understand I'm going to have an inspection if I take a Section 8 voucher or a veteran's voucher, that sort of thing. So I'm going to be proactive. And so they could reach out to the constable's office or even community development housing and say, okay, I know I've got improvements that need to be made. I know I'm going to need financial resources to do that. Can you help point me in the right direction so where
I can
find that
information? And that's a 9113, which I don't think we have a problem with that one. So I would suggest that we consider changing the language to say, consider developing a process to identify rental properties throughout the county.
You mean 9112?
9112, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So you would cut, after consider, you would just cut that language out in between.
Yeah.
So it would read, consider developing a process to identify rental properties throughout the county.
Okay.
And that way we start to get a way to match.
Yep. Amy, does there exist a coalition of these groups now that the people who housing advocates is there kind of a coalition of, because I mean we're always talking about creating task force and so on, but I don't want to see us create something that already exists.
So some of the municipalities are creating task force related to rentals,
right.
You know, particularly, you know, as it relates to trying to do a rental ordinance and inspections and the like. But there, as of yet, is not a coalition of housing groups that includes both for-profit and nonprofits related to the
rental.
Well,
just let me encourage you to consider doing that, to set up a private, let a private group come together, almost like an association or something.
And it might be something where the Sussex County Association of Realtors would be a support.
And that could very well be. And I would be happy to work with you on making that happen.
Was there a thing years ago, a big blow up over at Del Tech? Over this inspection thing, and they put about 10 of us troopers over there to make sure
that was an owner occupied. That wasn't a rental.
Different,
totally different.
I remember doing something over there.
It was a mess.
They put quite a few of us over there just to protect the council.
From what I understand, that would have been a like type that the housing code that we have right now, but it would not exclude owner occupied.
Right.
Okay.
So it would have been a stiffer. Or more up-to-date standard.
Okay.
And I think that's where that fell in.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks. So I've got the change to 9112. I think the next one would, I think this is more of you guys. So thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
So this is what Amy was talking about, a process to work with landlords who have limited access to resources to bring the properties up to code. That supports rather than penalizes those seeking assistance to improve the housing stock.
I don't think there's any problem with that.
You're okay with that
That's
one?
Fine.
Okay, good.
That's fine.
Okay, evaluate a current process for how group homes, shelters, and co-living arrangements are approved through county code to determine if revisions are necessary. So this
problem.
We just added, I think we added shelters and co-living arrangements to the original one we had proposed on Friday, which was just group homes.
Right. Okay. I don't think there's any problem with that either.
Okay. Strategy 9.1.2.5, consider development of a funding mechanism to provide home repairs on properties that do not have a clear ownership structure. Brandy, do you want to explain the issues with the ownership structure, or Brad?
Yeah. The federal programs that we work with to assist residents, they all require that that funding be secured, so we do put liens on the property. It's a prorated, non-interest-bearing lien. A certain percentage comes off every year, what would have to be repaid if the property sold.
Right.
We have a lot of properties that are, they're aired properties. Sometimes these go back generations. We still have family members living in them. We can't help them because we can't get a good solid ownership on the property, because in some cases there may be 32 yeah. owners.
It happens not. Where like the last deed you have, and I've worked with Brandy and Brad on this, and I know some of the other folks have too, where you know, the last deed you'll have will be from the 30s, 40s, or 50s. And it'll be, you know, title in Joe Smith's name, and it's technically stayed in the family of Joe Smith, you know, with people staying in that home. But over the decades, as Joe Smith passed away, and then his descendants passed away, and then in their case, you know, usually without a will, or oftentimes,
right,
you end up with multitudes of fractional interests in this property. And there's almost, I mean, and I remember even coming through with this on sewer projects, you know, where you almost get whole streets where there's not clear title, because there's never been a need for it. The people still live there, you know, the taxes are being paid or whatever in most cases. But it's the last deed is decades old. And so for, you know, for the engineering department to get an easement, you don't have clear title. And for Brad and Brandy's office to try to help them and put a lien on it, there's not one person, there's, you know, tens of people, if not 100, that have an interest in it, and it gets it hard to, you know, attach a lien or get paid back.
But how does the funding solve that problem?
Well, it's not so much the funding, it's more try to solve the problem so that we can make sure there's a clear, yeah, educate the people.
Well, can't you still attach a lien to the property?
You could, yeah, yeah.
I guess it's more, and as
Brandy, I think, just mentioned, it's also more, kind of goes hand in hand with getting these funding mechanisms available and educating the people that their hands are tied to some extent because they've got this title issue. Go speak to an attorney or somebody or legal aid or whomever to get that cleared up, because you know, you're being held back in what's available to you for funding because of the situation with your property. I think it's all sort of bundled together just in terms of outreach and assistance and reaching a solution for these property owners.
This particular item talks about providing a funding mechanism for home repairs, not the legal issue. Is that two different issues then we're talking about?
Well, that's kind of what Brandy or Brad was talking about.
Two different issues. Because we do have a...
Well, the clear ownership title, yeah. That's where it... Or clear ownership structure.
So the gap is maybe not the funding mechanism because there's federal funds, but the gap is the legal ownership issue.
It's the unclear ownership
unclear
issue.
Title.
Yeah.
So maybe we need to figure a different way to word this bullet so that we're hitting the right gap.
Okay.
And there's county funding available. I mean, it may originate with federal money, but that's the repair...
Alexis, you can just think about that,
okay,
and then come back with something a little bit later.
I don't have any trouble with it as a strategy necessarily, but
no.
it's just...
We want to hit the right gap. We don't want to, you know, if there's federal funding, but they're not be able to get it because of the legal title, then the gap is a legal title, not the funding, and we want to make sure we hit the gap.
And I will tell you, this is, I mean, you all don't deal with the planning and zoning, but this is not a small issue. It happens a lot. It happens in repairs to
the
homes.
Legal mechanism that needs to be.
Yeah, it happens.
Funding mechanism.
Where we see
work
it, one I've been involved in is where you have a failing septic, you know, community septic system, or individual septic systems where more than one home or dwelling's attached. You know, and you want to try to connect them with either county funding sources or the counties out there trying to reach a solution with DENREC and everything else. And because of that ownership structure issue, you come to a roadblock. So, it happens much more than you all probably realize. So,
yeah, Alexis, we'll let you work on that.
Yeah, we'll work, maybe even get some ideas from you dealing with it all the time, to come with the strategy.
Brandy and Brad both know it well.
All right. So, at the meeting on Friday, the... let's see here. It came up about elevating the idea of kind of filling that gap. I think the word was transitional, but not to use the word transitional. So what we did was we made the objective to reduce homelessness and displacement in Sussex County, and then we pulled a bunch of the strategies under that that would tackle that, both homelessness and displacement. So we talked about the gap when people, you know, are out of a home and need to find something else. So the first one was the one that we talked about last time, which was approved. Nonprofits said their stakeholders working to reduce homelessness. And then these were some other ones that were suggested to us. Support implementation of low-barrier shelters year-round in Sussex County. Explore opportunities to expand rapid rehousing and permanent supportive housing in Sussex County. And consider ways to support the repurposing and redevelopment of vacant properties into opportunities to reduce homelessness and displacement in the county. Did anyone have any concerns about these?
I have two questions.
Sure.
Can you give us a definition of rapid rehousing and a definition of permanent supportive housing?
Yes. So also back up just to explain the low barrier shelter. That came from, and I reached out to some of the homeless service providers and the Housing Alliance Delaware. And low barrier shelter is very similar to Code Purple, which I think most of you are familiar with, where basically there's no requirements to enter. You just kind of go in and you get your shelter, and it's the most vulnerable of populations, and that seems to be where the biggest need is around here, in addition to just shelter beds in general. But rapid rehousing, and I'll just read a definition if that's all right. Rapid rehousing is an intervention designed to help individuals and families quickly exit homelessness and return to permanent housing. And the assistance is offered without preconditions like employment, income, or absence of a criminal record or sobriety. And the resources and services provided are tailored to the unique needs of the housing. So that could be just helping someone with moving expenses or a deposit or utility arrears or something like that. If that's the only thing inhibiting them from getting, you know, that's something that's really easily addressed. And if that's what gets them back into housing, that's, you know, a really great way to spend resources. And then permanent supportive housing is supportive housing is an evidence-based housing intervention that combines non-time-limited affordable housing assistance with wraparound supportive services for people experiencing homelessness as well as other people with disabilities. So it basically provides that wraparound services that I think we've talked about, is ensuring that they have whatever they need, whether it's financial, case management, or you know, any of those services are available to them when they enter permanent housing, just to help them maintain that housing.
Now, as I recall, there were some NGOs that were at the commission previously that are somewhat filling this need. So you're saying it's just short?
In Sussex County, yes, definitely. A lot of the homeless resources in the state are very concentrated in Newcastle County and the city of Wilmington.
Sure. So then there's no reason why we shouldn't explore those opportunities, I don't think.
I'm good. I think that's a big key to keeping people in housing, is teaching them how to stay in housing and helping them through those the rough spots. So, yeah, I think that's a big deal.
And certainly low barriers shouldn't be an issue, right, Tom?
No.
Redevelopment of vacant properties.
So this was sort of an example. When this was suggested to us, was the example was the Belltown shelter. So that was, you know, sort of a vacant, abandoned structure. It was an old church, but, you know, it was repurposed for a shelter. So whether it's a commercial property or something else, but just a way to kind of, versus, you know, always having to construct new, if there's a way that we can reuse existing properties.
We call that infill, so that's cool.
Good. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm fine.
Okay.
All right.
We're good with all that.
Okay. The next strategy is a very specific one. Examine if a sliding scale fee structure for home buyers below a certain income threshold is feasible. And that would be, I assume, the transfer tax, right? To give some sort of reduction in the transfer tax to home buyers.
I don't know if I want to throw that out there.
No.
Gina may be listening, but no, this was, I think, just to explain that you know, we keep concentrating on developers and nonprofits, and this came from What if, you know, the average John Doe that is, you know, of low or moderate income wants to build a house or buy a house? What is it that the county can do to assist them directly versus going through a nonprofit or a developer? So, for example, we have the impact fee deferral that's currently in the code for nonprofits. So I guess if there's something like that for... And the sliding scale just means if you have someone of 80% area median income walks in, they receive less help than someone that's 30% AMI, whether that's a waiver or a deferral of some kind of fee. That's just to explain sort of the background of where that statement came from. So just worth throwing it out there for discussion.
So basically, like the same resources that are available to nonprofit organizations would be available to an individual that wants to construct their own home,
correct,
for example.
But there is, you know, to take into also consideration, there is a little bit of an administrative burden with that because it would require income verification and determination of what category they're in. And so I'm not sure exactly what department that would fall in, whether it's collection or Janelle's office or wherever. But, you know, so just that should be taken into consideration, too, is adding another layer. I think it's kind of like the elderly tax abatement that, you know, it's going on, but I know at the state level a lot of those programs are being adjusted, and so it's just something to consider as another option.
Wouldn't they already be vetted by another program somewhere if they were in that situation?
They may not necessarily be taking advantage of any other programs. I mean, you could just have someone that wants to build a house and they happen to be of moderate income, but they might not need
participating.
Right. Yeah, they might not be building through Habitat or Milford Housing. They just might want to build their own house. They got land from a family member and, you know, something to that extent.
Does that happen a lot? I'm looking at this and I'm trying to think of something. You know, I don't have a problem with it being a strategy, but I'm just can't seem to come up with a thing that would
kick in.
Would work, but
I mean, because I'm
not saying we shouldn't think about it. I'm just trying to.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think, I think in general, and I think Janelle's pointed this out several times, that compared to other counties, we're really pretty inexpensive in terms of fees and applications and that sort of thing.
Well, the biggest one is a real estate transfer tag. That's
absolutely.
5%, and we're not going to get rid of that. Emergency services on our end.
I think there's a first time home buyer or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Well, and we have, you know, we already have that, and the only thing you have left after that are building permit fees and water and sewer impact fees.
You can't touch the schools.
Water and sewer.
Right.
If you're in a water and sewer area, and of course we can't do anything about
the
school
impact
tax.
Fee, I think, is a large thing. However, you know, as Gina's pointed out too, is especially now with the uniform.
Sewer district.
You know, it's all kind of already divided out, so it's based on a certain number of users, and so it becomes really difficult that if we don't charge for one, then how is that going to offset the formula and how it's already divided?
I mean,
so there are definitely some things to consider, but that was sort of just the explanation.
I don't have a lot of hope for this one. But
no, we'll leave it in there, though.
But we can leave it in there, though. Yeah. Nothing wrong with leaving it in.
But when it doesn't get done, throw the flag up and say we didn't act on it.
Yeah.
We're just leaving doors open here, okay?
Yeah, we don't want to say don't look at it.
What did you say, Vince? What was
all?
It,
no,
19 or something last time?
Yeah,
there's
right.
like 100 this time. We're going to have, it's going to be,
well, they got to do something.
Come on.
We've got more time.
Yeah.
time. Just give her we have 10 years instead of 5 years.
That's true.
Right.
Right.
Double the amount of time.
It's a 10-year plan. It might be 9 years.
Last one was extended to 10. Okay.
Excuse me, Maury. That's a question I wanted to ask you, Vince. In terms of the law,
mm-hmm.
anything that requires that is in the plan that refers to an ordinance or so on, that has to be done in 18 months, right?
Supposed to be, yeah.
Right. All right. Something that's being examined, considered, explored, whatever, does that have to be done in 18? All to be done in 18 months? Too?
I don't know what the state would say, but I would argue that that's an ongoing thing that should be looked at all.
Absolutely, and that's where I don't want anybody to think that this is going to put pressure on county council to have to make every one of these decisions and explorations in the next 18 months.
And maybe that's frankly something we should put in the introduction as well.
Yeah.
You know, that the intent where, you know, where, because we've used the same sort of words like examine, consider,
mm-hmm.
and that type of thing, and even reference those. The purpose or intent is that they should be continuously revisited and examined throughout the 10 years, not that they're something that is intentionally an ordinance in 18 months.
Yeah, and some of the things are education and outreach, which would be ongoing naturally.
And it will be incumbent on those members of the citizenry that have an interest in a particular item to keep it in the forefront of the minds of, the, of county council, you know?
Yeah. Because there's some things that we've been pretty affirmative on, like the do X, Y.
Right, the things that say do something, well, that those are the things that I'm, like in my mind, that the law says has to be done in 18 months, but the ones that are just like this one, if we're examining something, well, we can examine it and re-examine
it. Yeah, and just to follow up on your question about, so with the comp plans, you have to remember that essentially the same law applies to municipalities as it does to Sussex County.
Sure.
And that 18 months also connects to the maps. And so with towns, you know, the towns, as I talked about 6 or 8 months ago when we sort of started this process, the towns have a more finite area, and in their maps they say, we want this to be this and this to be that and this to be this and this and that. And so that 18 months is supposed to be where you adopt the ordinances, meaning the zoning districts that match your maps. I mean, right. So it's real specific with the towns. Whereas with the county, you know, just because of the size and diversity of the county, we're never saying that this has to be the zoning. So there's not that exercise that applies for the county. So ours are more just general ordinances that we need to look at.
Right. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the discussion about the fees, this kind of leads into this question for the Planning and Zoning Commission. So we have a strategy from last time, explore ways to incentivize private developers to provide more multifamily and affordable housing opportunities. So my question here is, in the narrative, do you want us to elaborate out some ideas on how that could be done? Like, for instance, the things Brandy was talking about, like reduced or waived fees, density, height, expedited reviews through Janelle's office.
I don't,
or maybe make the strategy more detailed. I'm not sure where you guys want me to go with this.
Because we'll either leave something out or promote something in. They should be these options within the strategy so that we can refer to them and interlink them. I think if, you know, we're obviously going to be exploring post-comp plan building height and densities as a discussion. And that conversation is going to be tied to natural resource preservation because of the spatial build-out implications and the population build-out implications. So it's just too complicated to put into a words, in my opinion. I don't know, Bob, do you have any thoughts on the issue?
I don't know that we need to be overly specific here either. Some of these things, though, are going to be mentioned in other elements, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, height we've talked about in a couple different places and so on. If you feel a need to just cite some examples, just make sure that it says "but not limited to."
Yeah.
You know, that would be the thing. But I'm not too concerned about it being too broad at this point.
If you have examples of things that have worked, you know, that would be
good.
Yeah. You know, not necessarily here, even just elsewhere.
Some of these things may require code changes, which is why I think it's kind of just up for consideration or discussion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they definitely would.
The one example I think that is related to this is the deferral of impact fees. For example, right now nonprofits are eligible for this. They aren't charged an impact fee. So if, for example, Habitat for Humanity is making use of this in Ingram Village and Ellendale, so that upfront cost is taken away, which is great. However, when it's transferred to the new buyer, that is automatically due and payable, so they kind of have to work that into the financing. But for Habitat, I think it helps with that, you know, pre-development cost. So I think one of the part of the public comment about this was, should this be expanded for you know, our private developers of affordable housing? Can they also make use of that as long as they are, you know, we can ensure that they're truly providing affordable housing, whether they're using tax credits or something to that effect, or we can ensure that they are providing affordable housing. So that was, I think, just something to also consider is, right now the code permits nonprofit affordable housing developers, but what about the private
you know, affordable housing developers that also could use assistance. So.
And we do have that as a strategy that we talked about Friday.
That is an additional one. Okay.
Yeah, we pulled that out as a separate strategy about seeing if, you know, that could be expanded to more than nonprofits.
Make sure that's in the text, too.
Yes, because that's a specific strategy. But these other things, you know, do you want those all narrated out, like ways on how this could be done?
You know, I think they're going to, again, come out into the strategies. We're going to mention in just a minute about multifamily housing. We've already mentioned building heights and densities. Mm-hmm. The best thing we can do for housing costs, quite frankly, is to, you know, allow for building heights and densities to increase and get rid of the conditional use for multifamily housing in three of the residential districts so they don't have to go through a burdensome process, make it a permittable use. So those things... Hopefully, in 9235, we'll cross that bridge.
Okay. Another one here, 9317. This was also recommended from the public. Increased diversity in appointments for land use boards. So this is something that I believe Brad and Brandy's office have been hearing about from other groups. Anything to say to this?
What are we trying to say here, Brandon?
I know.
Come on, man.
Put me on the spot. So at the state level and federal level, we get regularly pointed out that Sussex County has, you know, there's not a lot of diversity on boards and commissions of appointed nature. So that's what that's coming from, and it's more, you know, just to make sure that we're accommodating the population of Sussex County.
We got a farmer, a state trooper, a commercial builder, a construction.
Somehow
construction.
I don't think that's what they're talking about.
Oh, different diversity.
Okay, well.
We just have to share the information, so.
Sure. And does that impact, I mean, how does that impact housing? Are we making bad decisions?
Is that a
land use decisions.
For funding? And
yeah, it's through land use decisions. Right. I think it's just, you know, decisions made at the board levels should, you know, appropriately reflect.
Okay. We'll accept that. Sure.
Okay. And then a couple more here, and these have to do with land use. So 9233, further promote and consider expansion of existing opportunities for affordable housing, such as the accessory dwelling unit ordinance. So this is the one we talked about last time that you guys had me coordinate with Janelle to find out the other areas in the code. So it was garage studio apartment ordinance, special exception for medical hardships, and the use of guest houses. So we just expanded that strategy to include those things.
That's good.
Okay. 9234, determine challenges and opportunities that could be associated with allowing multiple small units, such as tiny houses, on one lot, and if found feasible, determine if code modifications are needed. Yeah. Okay, so what we did here was there were quite a number of suggestions in the information we received from the public about tiny homes. And we do have that addressed in community design. Excuse me. But this is to, I think, get at the question of allowing multiple tiny homes on one property, and if there would be any sewer implications with that.
Did I say that right? This was the ECHO ordinance?
Yeah, so it was recommended that we look at an ordinance in, was it Newcastle?
Kent County.
That actually was for elders, right?
55 and older.
Yeah, 65 and older. And seeing if there was any language in that that could apply to allowing tiny homes on a property. So we decided to make this broad because there might be other issues too that could be.
Wouldn't there automatically be a septic or sewer issue if you did that?
Just in the EDUs, I mean, and what Pons is telling us is that we have pretty good capacity to absorb the EDUs. It's going to be more of a political capacity to absorb the tiny houses. So I don't see any problem with it.
Okay.
You okay?
I'm fine.
All right. The next one, consider broadening the product type in zoning that allows fee waivers for affordable housing to include multifamily housing. Ernie, do you want to explain what the product type was for this?
I think that's really what I was just saying about expanding the code to incorporate private developers of affordable rental housing. I think right now it's based on just nonprofit status, so multifamily would be automatically incorporated by expanding it to private. That's my interpretation.
We have, you know, right now, I think we have an AR, MR, and GR, where multifamily housing is conditional use. I think that's right. And so what that means is that it's not a permitted use, so somebody has to come in for conditional use to do multifamily housing. I mean, would it help Brandy if we made multifamily house a permitted use where central sewer and water is available?
I would think so, but I don't know. I mean, that's Janelle's question. I don't know. I'm not a planner.
That's more of a land use issue. I think this was just to create opportunities for the private developers to go through the same process as the nonprofit developers.
Facilitate promote land use policies, and that would be a land use policy issue, ordinance, whatever, right?
Yeah, it definitely could be.
I mean, I think it's something to consider. I mean, whether it fits in here or it fits in somewhere else, it's still an idea.
Be it design or here, would be the debate which
yeah,
one.
Yeah.
Maybe in both. I mean,
because that would, I think having some place where developers knew that multifamily housing was permitted, was allowed in that zoning category, could save a lot of time and trouble.
And the multifamily, I mean, really, that there's two parts of this. And I think what you're saying is add another strategy besides what's up there, because that 2.3.5 is different. But, I mean, there's whether it's allowed, that's one thing. You know, it ultimately comes down to the density. You know, you can have it in AR1. You know, what's the density you want to put in that? Is it still 2 units an acre? Is it, the bonus density we have, whatever. So.
Well, to Bob's point, that area of... If developers knew where we support multifamily housing, for example, is that whole areas of opportunity, which we're going to actually get into a little bit more. But in speaking with some of the financiers of affordable housing with the low-income housing tax credits and the Federal Home Loan Bank, by us sort of focusing on that and actually discussing and relying on areas of opportunity mapping through DSHA, that is lending a tremendous amount of help to developers by just incorporating that into our plan to say, look, the county is supportive of rental housing in this area, or home ownership in this area. That sort of adds support to their applications for that financing. So just that will be a great deal of help, and for you all to sort of understand where it should be directed based on infrastructure and schools and population.
But even even Vince and let's say it's just a more of a standard density of 2 units the acre, where now someone would have to come in with a conditional use for a multifamily housing. If we had it as a permitted use, you could have a mix. You could have some single-family housing, some multifamily housing. And then what Kim has been saying, then you have the opportunity to consolidate that open space into a more usable space. So I think it goes a little bit beyond the density. Density is an opportunity in that situation if we were to accept it.
Right.
But by tying it to central sewer and water, you're not saying multifamily housing in the lower density zone. You know, you're tying it to central sewer and water. Hopefully, we're investing that money wisely where a growth area is.
Yeah. I think it would have to be tied to water and sewer somehow.
That's all. So if water and central sewer, water and sewer weren't available, it wouldn't be a permitted use. But if it is, then you allow that option to occur.
But I don't disagree with that. Just you got to expand beyond just county water and sewer, because county sewer particularly, because we don't have much water.
No, just sewer and central sewer.
Well,
water.
Central. I don't care who owns it. Central system. Yeah.
Well, but that's just what I'm saying, Mr. Ross, to your point, if we're talking about having it out in the low-density areas, it's not a big deal for Artesian or Tidewater or somebody to put in central sewer out of low-density area. Right.
With the tier concept that Hans is using and with the strategies that we have, within utilities, hopefully we're going to develop a process to work with the Public Service Commission to more organize that into those tier groups.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I just think that low-density versus growth zones has less of a consequence if you're saying tie it to central sewer.
That's right. That's right. Yeah,
I get
exactly.
That. That's true.
Okay.
So do you want a new strategy about revisiting the code to determine if multifamily housing should be made a permitted use in certain districts?
Zones. Yeah.
Okay.
Where sewer and water is available.
You want to add that, water,
yes,
sewer?
Definitely.
Okay.
Yeah, because you're right. Yeah. You shouldn't do it otherwise.
It shouldn't be so broad as to put
otherwise
anywhere.
Yeah.
And just a clarification from the audience for net strategy 9235, for the product type, it was really implied specifically to the low-income housing tax credit
for
projects.
The waivers.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Can we specify that? Because okay. 7 years into this 10-year plan, yeah. We're not going to remember
it,
that.
Yeah. That's why
you right
wanted
in
to
there.
Add.
Put it right
add
in
the
there.
Stat, add the other one.
That way there's no question when we're all gone and the new diverse group is sitting here. everybody will know what we meant.
Yeah.
Other like USDA, but also, there's still other qualifying.
Still not read it, Bob, like you said.
Sorry. All right. One more thing. So we talked a lot about this last Friday, about listing affordable housing organizations in the plan for grant purposes, and then listing affordable housing projects in the plan. And Brad and Brandy reached out to a number of folks over the past week. Do you want to just give a quick update on what your conversations were?
So we actually went to the sources of the funding to see what would be the best way to, we just want to align our plan, obviously, to make sure that we can support these developers and nonprofits as best as we can. And it really sounded like we don't actually have to be that specific in the plan, as long really the land use is almost the more important piece by doing the areas of opportunity and sort of saying that this is where we support affordable housing or homeownership is actually going to do just the same, have the same effect. And just in terms of all, I mean, we have so many objectives and strategies and compared to our 2008 plan, so I think they're already going to be able to tie in to all different strategies versus 10 years ago. So I think that really is going to be a huge asset to them. So I think we're okay not doing that. We can certainly maintain a list in our office and refer to it in the narrative or something, but it actually makes it a little bit more difficult, because if we refer to a developer and then a new one is formed in 5 years, you know, then does that mean that they don't get our support? So I think it just, we don't want to be too specific and then be exclusive by accident. So
you could even end up the same developer that just changes its corporate entity.
Right.
And end up
losing
out. Yeah, I think that makes sense.
And also why I'm over here, actually, I think, Mr. Ross, you asked about USDA last time and how involved they are in Sussex, and I did receive some information, so I don't know if you wanted me to just clarify a couple of things. That they actually are not having trouble spending their funding allocation. I did ask for clarification about that. They actually sometimes have to seek additional funds to support the applications. And all of Sussex County is an eligible area. I looked that up this morning. Except I think all of the state is, really, except for north of Newark and the city of Dover, it looked like. And since 2011, the Single Family Housing Guaranteed Homeownership Program has helped over 1,900 low to moderate income individuals or families purchase homes in Sussex County. And since 2011, $21 million has been obligated in Sussex County through the direct mortgage product, as well as with their homeownership repair program. So there's been a pretty significant investment. And there are 38 multifamily housing complexes in Sussex County with over 1,300 affordable rental units, and over 1,000 of those are subsidized by Rural Development's Rental Assistance Program. And from 2009 to 2014, $32 million was obligated through Rural Development's Multifamily Housing Rental Assistance Program to Sussex County properties. And lastly, they also have a program which I wasn't aware of, but they have, Rural Development also supports a farm labor housing complex in Bridgeville. It's called the Elizabeth Cornish Landing, with 50 units, 42 of which are subsidized by Rural Development. And it's for tenants that are employed in the ag sector. So there are different sort of rental financing options through USDA that are available as well. So.
And now, with those USDA, are they administered by you all? Is that?
No, it's through USDA.
So, okay.
Mm-hmm. Rural Development. And then, Brandy, did you get do we have a full-size map of those housing needs map that you had, was it a couple weeks ago?
That's the next slide, mate. The areas of opportunity.
This from the state?
Yeah, that one.
Yeah, we can actually go. I put the link in here if you want to look at it today.
What's your sheer luck? people sheer luck. I have no idea what to put it up there. Randy, at some point, it'd be nice if Vince had that printed out, that full map
so
reference.
We got a received a copy of the GIS shapefiles from the state of these boundaries. So we'll be able to put it on top of everything we're looking at for future land use. If you need a copy.
We don't want to include that in the comp plan, but we want to reference
it. Right, but we have it to look at ourselves, and we can lay it over top whatever
Absolutely.
We want to.
Okay.
So let me just zoom in here. I've got Brandy up here, and we can show you some different things.
So just as a refresher, the yellow is the areas of opportunity where they the state suggests supporting new affordable rental housing. As you can see, it's mostly the east side where there's sufficient infrastructure. There's a lot of, there's high home ownership rates, but not a lot of rentals, and especially affordable. So that's where they sort of recommend. And that also incorporates school data too, of high performing school districts. The purple, I believe, is sort of the, blanking on the word, but there's already a significant amount, significant amount of rental, affordable rental housing. So Seaford and Laurel, you'll see there. So that's where they recommend home ownership, obviously to sort of stabilize the market. And I believe the blue is a stable market. So either, I think, is an option there. And everything else is out of play, where it would just be farther and farther away from infrastructure and sort of, I guess, what we would identify as level four, maybe.
What's the red outline mean?
That's, I think that's municipality,
is it?
Maybe.
No. I think it's downtown.
Oh, okay. Yes, that's an added layer. Yes, so you can add all kinds of layers on there. Yeah. Yes, right. Okay. Thanks, Josh.
Yeah, you can put your transit lines on as well.
Yeah.
Okay, that's cool that we can overlay that.
And you can, you can just enter in any address and see how it lies, and so developers have the option to kind of look at this
now,
as well.
Now, if we referred that in ordinance, and in some sort of affordable housing ordinance, and that changes over time, it flexes, but I mean, is that something that's advantageous or disadvantageous?
Yes, I think it's advantageous because the tax credit applications make reference to it, and so does the Federal Home Loan Bank also relies on this information. So the data is constantly changing. DSHA made it sound like they're going to update either annually or biannually. So we wouldn't have to actually be specific about the areas. We can just reference areas of opportunity, and they may change and flex over time. And so it's just a way. I don't think we're going to be exclusive to only supporting, but just to support those projects that are applying for those areas, because it would be helpful, I think.
And I think the best way to reference it in text is the map that is maintained by DSHA.
Yes, exactly.
Because that way then it's their map, it's maintained, we just reference that.
Yeah, we don't have to touch the data. They will continue to take ownership of that and maintain it, so we don't have to.
Oh, we don't have to reinvent the wheel? What?
And then as it changes, we don't have to keep updating everything. It just, that would be a good way to reference it.
It would be great, and especially if we could, as it's changed, get it to the developers, the different business people, association of realtors and all that, so that they can recognize where the needs are. It might incentivize them to come in and use that in their testimony supporting their project.
Yeah.
And this is definitely open to, it's a public website now, so anybody can access it as much as they want right now to look into that.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Okay, so that's all I had for housing. Were there any other questions about all the strategies once you saw them together? I'm going to make the tweaks we talked about today.
Now let's go ahead and make the tweets. Let's try to get the narrative drafted and all in one document so that we'll have something to look at, and then we'll see if any additional changes come to mind to the commission.
Okay.
And since we're done with housing, it's 12:33. Shall we break for lunch? Okay. We'll recess for lunch, 25 minutes.